From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise can help you manage your money in different currencies. With Wise, you can send money to your cousin in Australia in seconds. Travel internationally without having to brave an airport currency exchange desk or take the guesswork out of converting currencies. Wise lets you send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate, all without any hidden fees. Join 60 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. If you're a small business owner, you know that it isn't just your business, it's your life. And whatever your business might be, you want someone who understands. That's why you might want to check out State Farm Small Business Insurance. Why? Because State Farm agents are small business owners too, living and working in your community. That means they know what it takes to help you personalize your policies for your small business needs. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. Talk to your local agent today.
I don't think that there's any coincidence that Trump's kind of maniacal racism and hatred of the Muslims, Mexicans, and the blacks, that that happens while there is a simultaneous looting of resources from the bottom of society to the top.
Hello, welcome to The Clown Show on the Box Media Podcast Network. My guest today is Kianga Yamada Taylor. He's a professor of African American Studies at Princeton University, the author of From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation, and most recently, How We Get Free, Black Feminism and the Combahee River Collective. And How We Get Free is a fascinating book for some of the things I'm obsessed with right now, because Taylor is able to trace the term identity politics to its first usage, which is in this collective's manifesto. And it means a very different thing, a more inclusive thing, has a very different political project associated with it than what we think of as identity politics now. So as a piece of intellectual history, it's fascinating to me, and I was excited to chat with her about it. We also talk about some of her broader ideas, leftist critique of the Obama administration, and quite a bit more. My email, as always, is EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. Again, EzraKleinShow@Vox.com. Here is Kianga Yamada Taylor. Kianga Yamada Taylor, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
So where did the term identity politics come from?
Well, the phrase identity politics was first coined in the Combahee River Collective statement, which was a document that was created in 1977. It was written by three Black women who were members of something called the Combahee River Collective. And basically, it was a concept really to capture the political experiences of Black women and to, I think, really explain the source of Black women's radicalization as a way to say that the politics of Black women were shaped not by doctrine, not by political prescriptions that were quite heavy in the late 1960s and 1970s, but first and foremost, they were shaped by the experiences of oppression that Black women faced as people in American society. And so Demita Frazier and Barbara Smith's twin sister, Beverly Smith, developed this concept as a way of capturing those experiences.
Is that something different for Black women, that identity is the prism through which politics is shaped? Or is it something that was more visible to them and to the folks behind this collective because of the way their identities were treated by the mainstream? I guess my question here being, is identity politics something that is only true for certain identities, or is it something that is actually true for all politics, but it is less discernible when it's the majoritarian identities that hold power and render themselves less visible?
Well, I think, yes. On the one hand, identity, whomever you are, is a formative factor in the political ideas that you gravitate towards, what you decide to do, how you decide to act upon those ideas. That's all part of the formation of individual politics and to some extent even group politics. But I think what the women in the Combahee River Collective were trying to situate were the particular experiences of Black women at this historical conjuncture, meaning that many of them had been active in the anti-war movement, which was dominated by what they would refer to, and I think historically has been referred to as the white left. And they felt that within that milieu, that their experiences were not captured. And their experiences within the white feminist movement, Barbara Smith in particular, Barbara and Beverly Smith in particular, were active in the founding of the National Organization of Women, NOW. And so they felt that their experiences among white-led, white-dominated feminist organizations also didn't capture their history, their background, their politics. They also had this experience within the Black movement, which by the late 1960s has become even more dominated by Black nationalist politics, which are very masculine and male-oriented and focused. And so part of the project then of identity politics was to map out within this context, really, of the left, what was happening to Black women and how we could understand the political radicalization in particular of Black women. And so even though there is a, I think, universal aspect to which this framework holds true, I do think that the authors of this statement and the people who gave life to this political framework, this concept, were thinking very much about the situation of Black women at this at that particular historical moment.
One of the interesting pieces of your book is in your interview with Barbara Smith, she talks about her surprise at the way identity politics came to be understood as an exclusive, as a way of creating a politics that other people couldn't tap into, and how different that was from her understanding of it, which was that you would have to have many identities coming together. You would have to have a politics of solidarity if you were to have a politics that was effective at all. Can you talk a bit about the way the term mutated from feeling inclusive to exclusive?
Sure. And I think that, that happens, right? I mean, they introduced a term that in its actual time, I'm not sure if it even took on the significance that it would come to take on. And so they introduced a term, and in some ways it took on a life of its own. And I think, you know, in some ways that's an interesting way that language works. And, you know, there are phrases and political points and frameworks that mean one thing in one context and come to mean something somewhat different, in some circumstances completely different from the original intentions of the authors or progenitors of it. We think of a phrase like queer and its evolution over time. And so some of that has to do with the changing political context. And I think that is certainly the case with identity politics, which Barbara Smith not only was important in the feminist movement in the 1970s, but plays a pivotal role in the movement of feminist and feminist studies, what become known as women's studies, and the pivot to the academy in the 1980s. And I think that this was a common experience for different sections of the left who, I don't know if you could say they left the field of political activism, but I think that the terrain of political activism changed sharply from the 1970s into the 80s, and where the opportunities for movement building and for activism were dramatically different than they had been in the 1960s. And so you had an entire cohort of people go into the academy. And in some sense, they take these political frameworks, whether it's Marxism, feminism, in this case, something like identity politics, and they use these not only as having a past history as the foundation for strategic and tactical interventions in real live active struggles, but now they become units of analysis for understanding the world that we live in, but also perhaps a kind of prescriptive formula for the possibility of a different kind of world altogether. And I think that in the context of the 1980s, where there is a complete unabated retreat from the kind of political egalitarianism that in some ways was embodied in the expansiveness of the Johnsonian welfare state of the 1960s and the early 1970s, there is a sense of retreat, of being embattled. And for African Americans, and I would say Black women in particular, there is a sense of estrangement and deep political aloneness. And in that context, identity politics is no longer really a kind of tool of activists to be able to explain the particular worldview or set of experiences of Black women, but it becomes a way to differentiate Black people. And it's not just African-Americans. Identity politics becomes a way of explaining the social reality or is used as a way to explain the social reality of different marginalized, socially oppressed groups, and in some ways to explain why they are marginalized and why they are oppressed and why there is something unique to that oppression, which becomes a way of cutting that particular group off from other people. So that in effect, that without having this particular experience of an LGBT experience or a particular experience of African Americans or a particular Chicana experience, that there is no way for you to understand my oppression. And it doesn't necessarily mean that we can't work together, but there is something about that that even in some ways cuts off the possibility of activism or changing that situation. And I think that that has to do with the downturn in political activism, the feeling that Margaret Thatcher perfectly captured, that there is no alternative to this new social reality, that is then amplified again, you know, that we have reached the end of history, that there is no longer any conflict around the major ideas in the world, and that these kind of market-dominated racist societies are the best that we have to offer. And you really have to find a way to situate yourselves within that. So in many ways, I think that the deeply pessimistic use of identity politics is really just a reflection of the dramatically changed circumstances that come about with politics in the 1980s.
Tell me a little bit more about why that would be, because I understand, I think, the way in which making your identity legible to the people you're working with is a way of having your politics and making it possible for that politics to be interoperable with other people's politics. But tell me a little bit more about this theory, because I haven't heard it before, and it's interesting that it was in the Reaganite, Thatcherite move that turned into something closed off. Because the way it often seems to me is that there's a certain power in people foregrounding their identity, and then there was a backlash as people tried to take marginalized groups making claims and dismiss their claims, right? If what you want is identity politics, it's narrow, it's particularistic, it's a group. And what I want is politics, it's universalistic. Anybody can be part of it, right? It's for us all. Well, there's a real power in my position. I've really just grabbed the high ground. So it often seems to me to be an opportunistic sort of weaponized rebuttal. But I'm interested to hear this sort of alternative version of it, that maybe it actually was a response even among the left to a changing environment for organizing and activism.
Yeah, I think even if you look at the high point of the Black movement in the late 1960s, there is a backlash. There's an undeniable backlash, but there is also a way in which the Black movement, from civil rights, even through the urban insurgency, the Black urban insurgency through the middle to late 1960s, has a way of creating sympathy, even among a significant portion of the white population. It's very contradictory. So there were polls taken in the weeks and the month after the Detroit and Newark uprisings in 1967. These were Harris polls that were taken in that month of August. And what those polls point to is that for most white people, the riots have convinced them that we need a new kind of WPA program, that we need new housing programs, that we need an even bigger social welfare state to deal with these issues and problems that have been exposed by the Black movement. And so I think even in the turmoil of the 1960s and into the 1970s, there is still a sense of hope and possibility. I mean, Barbara Smith doesn't, and the Beverly Smith and Demita Frazier don't write the Combahee River Collective Statement until 1977. And so even by the late 1970s, there's still a belief that coalitional politics are not just desirable, but they're preferable. This is what we need to do in order to achieve some form of Black liberation, of women's liberation. And I think that 10 years later, or, you know, by the end of the 1980s and into the early 1990s, I think that that kind of hope and optimism, not just that, you know, coalition politics are possible, but the very basic idea that was palpable throughout the 1960s and the early 1970s, that we can actually change the world, we can change our society, that, you know, is connected to anti-colonial uprisings and the actual lived experience of seeing people change their society and change the circumstances under which they live, much of that has been crushed. And it's not just been crushed in a vacuum. It has been crushed through what you can describe as a weaponization of identity. So you get, you know, the welfare queen of Ronald Reagan, which, of course, is invented in the 1970s, but takes on an entirely new meaning in life in the 1980s. The war on drugs, the creation or the amplification of the notion of a Black underclass, which takes a hold of all social science study of all urban policy during that time period. And so in that sense, it's coming about at a time where it begins to feel like the possibility of change has been completely cut off. And so identity politics in that circumstance becomes almost a way of introspection, a kind of internal politics, a kind of way for oppressed and marginalized people to talk to each other and to really turn away from this idea of not necessarily coalitional politics with each other, but really, even in the 1960s, this was the idea of collective and social change was in some ways rooted with the idea that white people would resist the dominant social order and that white people could play some role in a movement to transform society. That is what was seen in the civil rights movement. It was seen in the anti-war movement, in the women's movement, even though there were deep divisions and debates and political strains and tensions. There was still an activist presence which could validate a sense that if they figured it out, if they got it right, we could build a type of movement that could transform society. And through by the end of the 1980s, there's none of that. There you have episodic movements among African Americans, among other marginalized groups of people, but it does feel like it's coming from the margin. It no longer feels like it has a mass character that is something that has the ability to shape and transform the United States in any significant way. And then you have the wholesale defection of many ordinary white people away from the Democratic Party into the Republican Party, which feels like it cuts off hope or the possibility of a different kind of that a different kind of world is possible. And so for me, that is where the pessimism, the isolation and marginality of identity politics in the 1980s comes out of. And in some ways, and it's not to, I mean, in some ways that can be read as blaming people who were victimized by racism. In many ways, it's a normal reaction to an increasingly suffocating racist society that the U.S. is becoming, which is in stark contrast, again, from what was happening in the 1960s, what was happening and believed was possible in the 1970s. There is a hard turn away from that. And the racism coming from the state in combination with the defection of ordinary white people from the Democratic Party and the sense of social justice that the state can be used for good is what Black people and other marginalized people are reacting to. So it's not a kind of self-generated nationalist impulse to pull away from politics. This is in reaction, I think, to what is happening socially.
What is your story for why you have that mass defection in the, let's say, the 70s and into the 80s? Because it does seem to me that there are some important resonances in that period, mm-hmm. and the one that we may or may not be in, right? I always want to be careful and humble about what story we're actually living right now. I'm not sure we always know.
Right.
But that moment where there's a moment, a feeling of possibility, a feeling that things could really be very different. And then there is like a revanchist backlash mm-hmm. that overwhelms that and makes them and pulls them further to the right in some ways than they'd even been, not in every respect, but certainly in economic respects. Mm-hmm. What is your story for what happened there and what needs to be learned from it?
There's a couple of things that are happening, both subjective and then objective. I think subjectively that it obviously has deeper roots than something that just appeared in the 1980s. I do think that in the aftermath of the 1960s, or in some ways as a direct result of what I described before, was the enormous sympathy that is generated by the Black movement, which is to say that prior to the 1960s, you know, the debates about the roots of Black poverty are, it's either biological or it's culture. But in either case, there is something inferior about Black people in the United States. And so the movement, both its Southern aspect and the insurgency outside of the South, or that is urban, located in cities, dispels much of that, which is to say that it is hard to characterize people as biologically or culturally inferior when they are fighting for the right to vote, when they are fighting to really be included in American affluence, even whether it is a civil rights march where people are dressed in their best clothing, or whether it is an insurrection in Detroit. That these are rebellions for inclusion, to be included in the largesse of U.S. society. And so in order to begin to fracture that, there is a, you know, there's a return to a ideological onslaught to basically try and undermine that notion of respect for African Americans, by, as Richard Nixon described it in the 1972 presidential election, turning that into a race around the welfare ethic versus the work ethic. And so there's a concerted effort at demonizing African-Americans and the idea that they are disproportionately dependent on the fragile welfare state in the United States. And so that comes along with a kind of political demonization of people as personally irresponsible, as defective, and as besieged by chronic domestic dysfunction. And so part of that is political. Part of that is about the U.S. Representatives of the U.S. state, mostly organized around the Republican Party, trying to divest the country from the Johnson welfare state. And so in that sense, if you reduce these problems not to one of structure, not to one of institutions, but to problems of personal defect, then really what we need is personal transformation as opposed to any kind of structural change. And that is a drumbeat that picks up in the early 1970s that seizes upon different crises in social welfare programs, whether it's the distribution of welfare itself, whether it's a low-income housing program that goes awry, that the problems of these programs are pinned on individuals and not necessarily on their operation or other problems unto themselves.
I agree on that kind of big picture demonization, but why do you think it works? Because that's where I always think the hard question is, that people are trying to push this. And for people who want to reform the system in more fundamental ways, and I think you're one of them, the question a little bit is, why do people pick up on that? Why, when you have that sort of effort at demonization, this effort to take things that are systemic and structural failures and inequities and turn them into individual failings and cultural problems, does it work and do people respond? And for the future, how do you inoculate them against that?
Well, I think it corresponds with common sense. I think that it corresponds with an idea that is quite prevalent in American society, which, you know, for all it's almost its entirety has denied the presence of classes, has denied that, you know, or has promoted the idea that the U.S. is a place of unfettered social mobility, and that, you know, if you work hard enough, then there are no limits to what it is that you can do. These are very powerful ideological tropes, especially when they are repeated over and over again, generationally. And then when you have some kind of, you know, over time, there's a way in which that logic lines up with what happens in people's lives. And so when you obscure the role of government and creating a massive white middle class in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, you marginalize the role of government and you sort of pitch it as, oh, this is the product of your own hard work. And when you see Black people living in ghetto, in isolated, segregated ghettos, well, that's a product of their lack of hard work. There's a way in which this corresponds with the common sense that people have about how their own lives work and how society functions. And I think that it's something that is reinforced over and over again. And so in the 1980s, when you have the onset begins earlier, but really the impact of what it means for an economy that was robust and boomed for, you know, for 25 years or so, to begin to go into decline, and for your life circumstances to begin to change, it's much harder to try to situate that, I think, to institutional forces when the drumbeat in politics is always about how these are the results of individual failure. And I think that that is always strategic, that when it's individual failure, then, you know, that's up for an individual to try to figure out. When it's systemic failure, it requires much more. And the way that narrative changes has always been through mass political struggle, whether it was in the 1930s or whether it was in the 1960s. And outside of that, the explanation of individual failure has come back. And I think that that is very powerful and sustained over decades. And that becomes the easy explanation for things when you're fed that on a regular basis. I think we can see it today in the way that the debate slowly begins to change about immigration, you know, and that maybe there is something to the presence of immigrants that has to do with my own individual economic situation. Maybe there is something to Black crime in Chicago and all of these other cities. And why can't those people get their stuff together? I think that the steady drumbeat of that over time that is accepted by liberals, by conservatives, by the Democratic Party to varying degrees, and certainly by the Republican Party, it becomes a kind of one-sided narrative for how we understand progress, how we understand poverty in the United States that only gets disrupted when social movements emerge that challenge that dominant narrative.
I'll be right back with Kianga Yamada-Taylor after a short break.
Support for The Gray Area comes from Mint Mobile. When you hear secret sauce, maybe you think of the mysterious ingredient in your favorite burger. Or perhaps it's your grandmother's terrifying meatloaf, which somehow seemed to secrete sauce. But from now on, when you hear secret sauce, I want you to think about Mint Mobile. Their secret is that they only sell wireless service online. That means they can cut the cost of retail stores and pass those savings directly to you. By switching to Mint Mobile, you can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/gray area. That's mintmobile.com/gray area. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/gray area. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Support for this show comes from NetSuite. All too often, people like the owl monkey and the Australian sea lion only see the world in black or white. Now, regular listeners of this podcast, who are mostly humans, understand that the world is more complicated than that. There's also plenty of gray areas. The world of business is a great example. See what I did there? An S&P 500 company and a small business owner have to see things differently, which is why NetSuite wants to provide products and services tailor-made for any business. NetSuite is a top-rated cloud financial system that brings accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into a single platform. NetSuite lives in the cloud, which can reduce IT costs and can improve efficiency and cut back on mistakes by bringing all your major business processes into one platform. NetSuite says that more than 37,000 companies have already made the move. Maybe it's time you did the same. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. You can head to netsuite.com/gray area. netsuite.com/gray area. netsuite.com/gray area.
I think it's a good bridge to your book, From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. And in it, you talk about police violence as linked to broader conditions of inequality. The only way to end violence is a broader restructuring of society. Can you talk a bit about that argument in that context?
Sure. I mean, part of the argument around the persistence of police brutality over time, which is to say, as I write in the book, that there is no golden age of Black relationships with the police, for that as long as Black people have been an urban population since the early, since the 20th century, that abusive and violent policing has been a feature of that. And so when I write about the particularities of the 21st century, and what in some ways is different is the way that policing has become the public policy of last resort. meaning that in many localities where there has been, a bipartisan decision in some ways that we are no longer going to expand not just the social welfare state, but the public sector in general. And so what that means in education is a pivot to more privatization, charter schools, shrinking the imprint of the public sector on the delivery of education, on the delivery of healthcare, on the delivery of water and other public services to give the private sector a bigger role. And that the impact of this in African-American communities, both urban and suburban, has been not good. And that is evidenced by growing rates of unemployment, of poverty, and all of the social crises that come from that combination of factors. And so instead of investing in programs and policies as a way to attend to that, municipalities have decided to invest in policing. I write about Chicago, where in 2012, 52 public schools were closed, and budget deficits were a driving explanation as to why that had to happen. There was talk about underpopulation in the school buildings, but really the overriding factor had to do with deficits. But then you see that the city of Chicago has literally spent more than $500 million to settle cases of police abuse and murder over a 10-year period. And so you see that when it comes to some finances, then we're willing to figure out a way to make that happen, where in other cases, that's not the case. And so this is part of the kind of social reality now, where there is still almost a complete reluctance to engage in the kind of institution building that has historically been somewhat effective in stemming the crises that arise in urban settings and suburban. And now the majority of Black people live in suburbs that are appearing in poor and working class suburban areas, and that policing has become the way to deal with that. And, you know, attendant to that has been imprisonment and what people refer to as mass incarceration. Those three factors have worked collectively that has resulted in the premature death, disappearance of young Black men. It has led to police state-like conditions in many Black majority communities. And so looking at this over time and seeing this as a recurring feature in some form or another over the last century, and certainly in the first two decades of this century, for me in that book raised the very specific question as to whether or not we can ever expect a different outcome in American society, given this kind of social arrangement and the persistence of this problem.
So the big point you make on that in the book is that you write, capitalism is contingent on the absence of freedom and liberation for Black people. Do you want to expand that argument a bit?
Sure. I mean, I think, again, that this is a conclusion that, you know, I have drawn looking at the conditions of African-Americans from emancipation to the current moment. And for me, that was really captured almost symbolically by the murder of Freddie Gray in Baltimore in April of 2015. And when I was writing about that, I realized that Freddie Gray was picked up by the police almost to the day of the end of the Civil War, the formal end of the Civil War, the signing of the armistice at the Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia. And that was it was 150 years to the day, and it was a very powerful symbolism. And the idea that, you know, this war that was supposed to usher in a new period of freedom for Black people, and here we are 150 years later, where parts of that are true. And I looked at the city of Baltimore, where you had at the time, a Black woman who was mayor, a police chief who was African-American, half of the police officers implicated in the murder, who were eventually exonerated, but who were implicated in whatever happened with Freddie Gray, were African-American. A significant portion, I think maybe half of the city council in Baltimore, African-American. You know, 40 miles from the White House or from Washington, D.C., where the first Black president was residing, in the same city where the first Black attorney general was residing. And if all of that Black institutional power couldn't prevent Freddie Gray from having his neck snapped, then it raises questions about what will it take for Black people to be free? And what I meant by freedom was, what will it take for Black people to have a level of self-determination that is not motivated by economic coercion, physical coercion, or any other coercive element in society, where people are making decisions based purely on what is best for them and their family? And so I cannot imagine in this society where the way in which it is currently organized under capitalism, that this is something that is possible, because there's not a single period in the last 54 years, where that has been a possibility. And at every step along the way, there has been what has been presented as an achievable goal. So we have emancipation, and then there's a 100-year lull, but then we have, well, let's get rid of Jim Crow. We can get rid of second-class citizenship. We can obtain the right to vote. For African-Americans, both South and North, East and West, in the late 1960s, we can enter into politics. We can become a part of the political class, so that it's not white people governing us in the places where we live. We can govern ourselves. And so now we have 50 years of that. And at the end of it, we get Freddie Gray and his broken neck. And to me, that was symbolic of a broken political and economic system that in 150 years of freedom has not been able to produce substantive freedom for the vast majority of Black people in this country.
I guess I wonder, though, why you turned to capitalism on that. I mean, I think a lot of the problems you just pointed out with capitalism are very present, but are there alternative economic systems that seem to generate a level of equality and tolerance that we don't see here? I mean, I'm Jewish, and under communism, we didn't do great. And so I wonder about whether or not the economic systems are really what is driving what seems to be a tendency in societies to latch on to difference, and attack it and find outgroups and treat them horribly, going all the way back through kind of almost every version of human organization we can think of. And sometimes we do it on religion, and sometimes we do it on race, and sometimes we do it on class, and sometimes we do it just because, like, they're over there and we're over here. But why capitalism? Like, how is that the root cause that you identified?
Well, I think that there is a particular relationship to capital that African-Americans have. So if you get the entry of Black people, Africans, into what becomes the United States as property, and that the entire political history, the economic history of African people in what becomes the United States is completely bound up with what becomes capitalism, with what becomes a kind of market-based economy. And I think that is hard to separate from the experience of African Americans. So I don't deny that there is a global history of what it means to be an other, what it means to be viewed outside of a dominant group in a particular place. The problem, I think, is when that is then mapped onto an economic system that appears to thrive on exacerbating difference. I think by the arrangement where under capitalism, you have a small, tiny group of people who control the vast majority of resources. And the question I always try to think about, to use the framework of the Occupy movement, how does the 1% retain such dominance over the 99%? And it is through division over and over again. I don't think that there's any coincidence that Trump's kind of maniacal racism and hatred of the Muslims, Mexicans, and the Blacks, that he pounds that drum louder than anything else. And I don't think it's any coincidence that that happens while there is a simultaneous looting of resources from the bottom of society to the top, like generational theft of resources from bottom to top. I think that those two things work hand in hand. And I think that if we look throughout American history, there has been an obvious effort to harness racial resentment, racial fears, to stoke them, to fan the flames, while simultaneously stealing from the poor and working class to redistribute that wealth to the powerful. And so, you know, there is an aspect of which you can say that separating out or blaming others or looking for people to victimize is evident throughout much of human history. I would say perhaps not all of human history. I think that there are very interesting indigenous social developments. What was the North America and throughout this hemisphere that may have looked at the social organization differently than in other places. But I think even where there has been a proclivity towards demonization and blaming others, that there's something else that happens when you map a profit motive onto that, that accelerates that process, that brings a lot more resources to that process, and that amplifies the potential impossibility of destruction, of human destruction into that process.
Yeah, I think there's something to the idea that if you harness capitalism or any of these, I mean, for that matter, democracy or a bunch of the other sort of running systems we have into kind of its evil dimension, you can have this tremendous amplification. And then you can have it seems to me, go the other way. I mean, something I was thinking about while you were talking about the tendency of folks on top to use division to retain their statuses, I think that's, on the one hand, entirely true. And on the other hand, if the top 1% were voting, I mean, I'd have to look at this, but from what I've seen, I think Donald Trump wouldn't have been elected. As people, like, he does not do better among richer people. He is not, there are a lot of people in the top 1% who find him odious. And one of the things that strikes me within all forms of, to connect this in some ways back to our identity politics conversation, is that one of the tricky things in when trying to build a politics out of an identity is to overwhelm its internal differences, right? That there's the 1% becomes an identity. Certainly, it becomes an outgroup. But, you know, you have 1%ers who are incredibly conservative and incredibly liberal. You have people there who want a lot of justice and people who don't. People just don't care, right? You have a lot of alienated and selfish folks in that community. And so there's this way in which, I don't know, I've been thinking a lot about difference and how identity gets harnessed for this book project I'm doing that we were chatting about earlier. And the thing that is so striking to me about it is just, it seems to me that you can pull up the human tendency to see difference so easily, and you can pull it up in so many different contexts, that there's always this dream that we will find a context that will free us from difference. We will find a context in which people will finally see that they're one, that they are together, that at the very least are many more of them who share interests than who don't, and that that hope, while it emerges in some ways, right, you know, nations are able to bring together more people than you were able to have, you know, when we were in small hunter-gatherer tribes, that we're in this just constant war with the part of the human psyche that wants to find a group to compete with, that wants to find a group to blame for our problems. And as you say, that can be harnessed and it can be fought against, and people at all levels of society do both. But it seems to me, when I look around at other societies, that I can't find the one that solved it, right? Which makes me think that it runs deeper than something particular to ours.
I don't think that for, just on the question of Donald Trump and the 1%, I don't think that there has to be a single particular way with which a dominant class can exert its politics or authority. So Donald Trump is one manifestation. But, you know, I'm always wary of people who counsel, you know, Joe Biden, who thinks that we just need to get back to normal. And, you know, I think about under Obama, who is the complete antithesis of someone like Donald Trump, that many of these same dynamics are in play. They look differently. But there is a reason why there was a Black Lives Matter movement that exploded, erupted during the presidency of Barack Obama. For all of his well-spokenness and good manners, and the, again, antithesis of the kind of boorish racism of Donald Trump, there is a similar kind of outcome that has now, of course, been accelerated by the Trump administration. So I don't think that there is a particular way that the still kind of domination of the 1% expresses itself. The Occupy movement developed under the Obama administration as well. And so I think in terms of society, is there a different way to organize our society that'll produce a different outcome? You know, I used to think that I knew the answer to that, and I've actually tried to become a lot more humble about what I think I know. And so I don't know. To be perfectly honest, I have no idea. I think that there is a better way. I think that if we even, I'm not talking about full-blown, you know, communism, but even if we were to implement the very tepid reforms that Bernie Sanders has championed, universal health care, free college, you know, things like this, the basic social democracy that has existed elsewhere in the world, which one tells us that it's not the solution to all of our problems. But could it actually transform the lives of millions of people in the United States? Yes, I think so. And then beyond that, I don't know if we had a society, and I talk some about this in the Black Lives Matter book, probably without fully developing it, but the idea of what it would mean to have a society where those who created the wealth and resources in our country were the ones who were actually in charge of how they are distributed. What if those people were the ones who were in charge of how decisions were made, how our society was functioning, governed, what it might look like, how might that be different? Because the way that it is now is we have a Senate where the average wealth is $3 million. We have the House of Representatives, where I think the average wealth is $990,000, where you have literally the Congress is made up of millionaires and is led by a billionaire president. And meanwhile, you know, the median income for African Americans is somewhere around $40,000 for white people. You know, it's between $60,000 and $70,000, and so there's a mismatch between the people who govern this country and what the lived experiences are of the vast majority. And so I don't know if we flip that, if we had the people who are currently, you know, on the bottom 99%, actually in charge of directing this society. I don't know what kind of difference that would make, but I know that it would be different. And I guess I've reached the point where, and I think a lot of people have reached the point, and it's evidenced in the fact that you have an open socialist who is a leading contender for the Democratic Party nomination. It is something that is hard to believe if you are a student of American history in the 20th century in any serious way. This is an unbelievable development. And how has it come to be? Because the status quo, is not working. And so I don't know if that means that, you know, people are ready for socialism or if socialism would, quote unquote, work. But what I do know is that the arrangement that we have now isn't working. And if it were, you certainly wouldn't have a person describing himself as a democratic socialist as a possible candidate to be the nominee for the Democratic Party. And that, I think, speaks volumes of what I think is, it can only be described as a political crisis in the United States. That speaks volumes about it.
This is a good time to squeeze in a quick break. We'll be right back.
Wise is the app that makes using different currencies easy. Need to send dollars to your cousin in Bali fast? Getting paid in another currency and don't want to lose out because of inflated exchange rates? Want travel money without having to slog through the currency exchange kiosk? Then Wise just might be your answer. From pesos to pounds, euros to yen, Wise takes the guesswork out of converting currencies. You can send and spend money worldwide at the real-time mid-market exchange rate with no markups and no hidden fees. In 2023, people sent over $100 billion worldwide with Wise. What's more, over half of those transfers got to their destination in less time than it takes to listen to this ad. Whether you're traveling, spending money abroad, or doing business, let Wise help you manage your money in different currencies with ease. Join 16 million customers already using Wise worldwide. To learn more about how a Wise account can work for you, download the app or visit Wise.com. That's Wise, W-I-S-E.com. Wise.com.
This episode is brought to you by State Farm. You've heard it before. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there. But it's more than just a tagline, because State Farm agents are small business owners themselves who live and work in your community. And if you're in the market for small business insurance, who better to work with than an agent who understands what it takes? State Farm agents can help you create a personalized insurance plan that fits your small business needs and budget. Talk to your local State Farm agent today about small business insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
I want to go back to something you said about Obama, because it informs some of my thinking about Sanders too, which is the point you made that there is, viewed from one perspective, an irony, viewed from another perspective, a lesson, that it was during the administration of the first Black president, the rise of Black Lives Matter, that he sent, followed by Donald Trump. That here you have this leader who, for better and for worse maybe, really in his own politics tried to be consensus-oriented, tried to bring down tensions, tried to hear all sides, and that he himself was an incredibly polarizing figure. He was racially polarizing. He was politically polarizing. He was polarizing at almost every level, even though his whole political career and personal brand was about depolarization. And one of the things that it's made me more respectful of is the way that change releases its own energy, that it releases its own counter energy, right? It's no accident, to your point, either that Black Lives Matter emerges during Obama, or that he's followed by Donald Trump, right? Or that he's followed by if you pulled the antimatter out of Barack Obama, you would get Donald Trump. And I think I'm starting to see this now in the Democratic primary too, where and this maybe also goes back to our conversation about the 70s, where there's the rise of a much more left Democratic Party, much more left on economics, much more left on social justice, much more left than Barack Obama on things like immigration and racial justice. And that's also pushing and going to push the Republican Party to the right and create its kind of like own backlash politics. And there is some way in which like a lot of the force in politics comes from this question of when a movement emerges, is it able to overwhelm the backlash it creates to itself? Or does the backlash it creates to itself overwhelm the movement? And I think we're really like with Obama, I think we honestly don't know yet. You know, we'll see if it looks like Donald Trump, you know, 10 years from now was the last gasp of something or was the reemergence and re-empowering of it. With Bernie Sanders, I have no idea, right? I mean, you could imagine maybe he gets elected and does Medicare for All and it blows up like the Clinton 1994 plan. And then there's like this like dark winter for healthcare for 20 years like there was after that. And it's made me much more, I don't know if pessimistic is a word. I don't think that's quite the right word, but it's made me much more cautious. Because I always have a tendency to look at, I'm somebody who is excited about the prospect of political change usually, and I have a tendency to look for its threads emerging and then you know, imagine where they could go. And it so often seems to me that change brings the very thing that unwinds it with it in American life, particularly given how difficult our system is and resistant it is to any kind of big systemic change. And it just creates such a difficulty for trying to follow or imagine where any of this would end up. I just would have never imagined at the beginning of Barack Obama's presidency that this is where we'd be either on the right or the left, you know, a couple years after its closing. And maybe that was my own naivete.
No, I don't. I mean, I don't think anyone could have predicted this. I do think that what some of us did predict, that it didn't happen, is part of the problem, which is, I think, you know, Obama is running and is elected in the midst of extreme economic crisis, historic crisis. And I think what many of us thought was that he would take his mandate and really impose a kind of recovery that was to the benefit of most ordinary people. And instead, the exact opposite happened, where the banks are bailed out and there's a, you know, priority placed on making sure that the economic institutions are best situated. And, you know, you can talk about the logic of that and whether it made sense. But the reality is that very quickly established a pattern in the same way that the public option for Obamacare was immediately, you know, given up. And so I think that, to me, it's not quite accurate to say that Obama, you know, was the consensus candidate, you know, or president who wanted to just get buy-in from both sides and just toe the middle line. I think that Obama was always very quick to capitulate the left side of the aisle or the Democratic side, that he would go above and beyond to appeal to Republicans as a way of showing his goodwill in governing. And I think that, you know, that was a mistake coming out of the disaster of the Bush years. And I think for young Black people and also for the young people who made up the heart of the Occupy movement, many of whom had worked on Obama's campaign. The same thing with young African-Americans, people who voted for Obama like they had never voted before. And to constantly, for at least for young Black people, to not only not have a president intervene on their behalf, which is the reason why he was elected for, in their eyes, which is the reason why he had a historic turnout of African-American vote, was demoralizing over and over again. And not just a kind of betrayal, you know, whether it's Troy Davis and not intervening to even make a statement on behalf of Troy Davis, the Black man who was on death row in Georgia for a crime he didn't commit, but to then insult Black people at almost what felt like every opportunity. So the jokes about, you know, Black parenting and, you know, Black mothers feeding their kids cold fried chicken in the morning, you know, getting Uncle Pookie or Cousin Pookie to get the vote, just saying things about Black people that no white politician could ever get could ever get away with was insult upon injury. And so I think in that context that, you know, it's not just that, oh, this is, you know, some process by which, you know, this is just what happens when dramatic change happens. It creates a backlash. Yes, to some extent, that's true, but it's also rooted in actual things that did happen and that in many cases did not happen. I think with African Americans, that the police murders of young Black people and what felt like the utter impotency of the presidency to be able to do anything. We're constantly told that, you know, this is a jurisdictional issue. The president's powers are limited. But they always seem limited when it comes to what can be done for Black people, what can be done for poor people. When it comes to mobilizing power, you know, whether it's for war, internationally, whatever, then there does not seem to be the same hesitations. And we can talk about, well, of course, that is the domain of executive power. And this, you know, we have a federal system within the United States. And, you know, there are limits to executive power. That might be true. But the way that people experience this on a day-to-day basis, it doesn't matter. And this is what fueled the radicalization. And I would also say, which I think is important, that this leads to Trump, I think, is a part of that process, the kind of constant halfway measures of the Obama administration and the failure to really follow through or to achieve, for whatever the reason, for whatever the political reasons, the Republican Party was horrible and racist. They weren't going to give him anything. But whatever the explanation, the inability to follow through and deliver the things that actually mattered to people, you know, creates the conditions for Donald Trump to be able to assume the presidency. And that's not just a phenomenon in the United States. I think that we can see in many places around the world where right-wing nationalists are taking power. It's the failure of the neoliberals and the third way to deliver substantive change in the lives of ordinary people that creates the opening for you know, these crypto fascists to be able to step in and say, we can fix it. We can solve these problems.
So there's a bunch of super interesting things there. I would cut two things apart a bit to try to synthesize something that I think is interesting. So you know much more about the relationship between Obama and the African-American community, and particularly around the police shootings. And I wouldn't try to reinterpret that. But I covered the healthcare and financial crisis efforts pretty deeply. And this is actually part of why I think change ends up holding its own backlash inside of it. So, you know, something you said a couple of times is that we can talk about the logic of why they had to bail out banks to save credit markets, or why the president's powers are limited in this or that domain. But the experience of it is that it just totally sucks and it's terrible and people suffer. But I do think that there can be a tendency to wipe away those first parts a little bit too easily, that, you know, America came through that economic crisis both terribly and better than virtually any other country that absorbed a crisis like that ever. When they, like, I remember talking to them and trying to work this through and talking to economists about, like, what could you do with the banks? What were the possibilities? And I am of the opinion there were better things that one could have done. Like, I would have liked to see cram down, where people wrote down the mortgage notes on the banks. And I think there's more populist things you could have done that would have helped somewhat. But in terms of, like, TARP and this incredibly infuriating thing with the banks, I think that if you hadn't done it, the level of misery would have been unbelievable, would have been much worse than what we had. Or, you know, when they actually did try to do something more populist in HARP, which was like a more of a actually not that well constructed, but nevertheless a direct effort to help homeowners. That's what created the Tea Party. Or the public option. I mean, I covered, oh God, did I cover that one? And like, they got healthcare for 10, 20 million people, and they couldn't pass it with a public option because they did not have the votes. And something that I think about with Bernie and this sort of emergent, I think you are completely right to say that the radicalization that has followed Obama, both in terms of Donald Trump and in terms of the left, is in some ways a reaction to a president who got a lot of things done. And in getting that much done, both in terms of what he symbolized and in terms of what he literally did, like with Obamacare, he created a reaction on the right, which led to Donald Trump, but he also created a reaction on the left, which led to people saying, no, more. Like, how could you have stopped there more? Like, why did you let this go? And what worries me about that reaction is I don't hear an answer for any of the things that stopped him. And I'm not asking you to give me one. This is more an observation I'm making. But although if you have one, that'd be great. but I talked to the Bernie Sanders people and I talked to the folks who are supporting Warren or any of them. And, you know, what you do about the Senate, like there's no answer. Like Bernie doesn't even like to talk about the filibuster. Forget like doing something bigger than that. And so I think that there's this tendency to look at Obama and say he didn't deliver when he got much more done than anybody had for quite some time before him. But it is completely true that what he got done was frustrating. And in the way it got done, it was limited and it was half measures and it felt like so much less than we needed. And all that was true. And yet I don't understand the theory people have coming out of it that, well, maybe somebody just pushes harder and faster because they're just going to run into the same things with actually less power than Obama had with 60 votes in the Senate. And there just seems to me to be a like an unwillingness to grapple with like the institutional constraints of American political systems, which I understand. I don't want to take that away from everybody. It's not that everybody has to cover politics professionally, but it's more that if people don't do that, that same cycle of hope following disillusionment, if Bernie Sanders gets in and there are 52 Democratic votes in the Senate or 49 and he gets nothing done, what is going to happen to this whole generation of people who is certain that getting a social Democrat in office was going to change everything, only to find him like doing overtime rules for the Department of Labor? That there's this weird unwillingness when I read some of the folks on the left to really grapple with what stopped Obama from not being as far left as maybe they are, but at least as far left and as reformist as he wanted to be, which was a constant tension of that administration.
I mean, I think part of it is understanding that the type of political change that people who are attracted to Sanders, for example, the type of change that people want is not something that can only be created at a formal political level. So when Bernie Sanders talks about the political revolution, the way that I interpret that is an understanding that Bernie Sanders could become president tomorrow. And if there is no grassroots movement on the ground that can articulate and give voice to Medicare for All and what that might mean, that won't happen. And so if there is no independent force outside of formal politics that creates a real grassroots pressure to force the Congress to create bills that at least somewhat resemble the demands of the populace, then it's not going to happen. And I think, you know, to that extent, I do think that there can be a failure to understand that American politics are set up to not work. I mean, we talk about it as checks and balances and the different levels or wings of government, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial, as this is some sort of, you know, positive thing. Or even, you know, within the relationship between Congress, the legislative and executive, and that they're set up for gridlock. They're not set up for to work, that it is incredibly difficult to get two chambers of Congress and the presidency to actually be in sync on particular policy questions. And that typically the way that that has moved forward in like really big, robust, and substantive social society changing policies has come through mass pressure. And so I would agree that part of the limits. You know, if you think about something like Black Lives Matter and the Obama presidency, you know, social movements don't win just because they should. And, you know, that there has to be a way of organizing beyond the momentum of events. And that if you don't have that component to the organizing, then you kind of defer to politics, which is sieged by conflict and in many ways is not the most effective way to pursue a social agenda. So I agree with the complications, but I think part of it is an answer that doesn't actually have anything to do with the process itself, because you have seen quite substantive shifts in policy. But again, it has coincided with massive social upheaval. And without that, we are quite naive to believe that there would be something resembling substantive change in the country without it.
I think that's very right. I mean, something about the financial crisis in particular that when I at some point wrote this like very big sort of retrospective of the first year of it for the Washington Post, and I was talking to historians of the Great Depression, and a point they made a couple of times is that by the time Franklin Delano Roosevelt came in, it had been going on a long time. That it like the economy was in utter freefall. When Barack Obama came in, it had begun. And there's this there's this kind of famous thing back then where they bring out this projection about why they need the stimulus. And in their projections, even if you don't have it, unemployment only goes up to 8%. And in reality, a couple months later, unemployment is already at 10%. So like their projections were totally wrong about how bad this was going to be, which was, you know, whatever. These things are hard to project. I don't exactly fault the economists for that. But there's this interesting like counterfactual of if the election had been 1 year later or 2 years later and unemployment was 10.5% when he comes in, well, what's possible then? Right? Because your point about social movements coming in these times of upheaval, I think, is really well taken. The only other thing I will add on this is something that I just struggle to think about, because there is a tension, it seems to me, between social movements and politics, which is that politics is demobilizing for social movements. So like using the Affordable Care Act as an example, you could imagine when that started a real social movement, and they tried to build one in certain ways. People are critical of what they did with Organizing for America, and I honestly don't understand the guts of all that well enough to truly adjudicate that argument. But you can imagine a movement for universal health care. And then at some point, Ben Nelson, who is the Nebraska Democrat but is in a red state where Barack Obama is unpopular, is beginning to cut things out of the bill. And the movement is getting pissed because the people who are in the movement want the bill to be bigger. And every time you make one of those compromises to get a Ben Nelson, a Joe Lieberman, you name your person, an Evan Bayh onto the bill, the movement feels a little bit betrayed. And so the thing that seems to me to happen repeatedly is like these movements begin to fail as presidents try to achieve the thing they want, because the thing they want can't make it through the political process, particularly given everything you said so eloquently about the way our system is set up, which is pretty right-leaning, actually, given how much more conservative land is than people. And so there just ends up being this thing where in campaigns, there's a lot of hope around movements. And then when the person leading that movement from the outside goes inside and begins to try to deliver on those promises and make those concessions, then they become part of the establishment and part of the problem. And then people are disgusted with them in turn. And that's just it just seems to me like a true problem that people don't really know how to solve.
There's something about the need for some level of independence, but even without the illusion that you can produce the kind of, you know, uncompromised legislation. I mean, it's not possible in the political system and the political tools that we have. But the problem that we have now, I think, is that the elections. So 2020 becomes so big as the rebuke to Trump, as an opportunity to start anew, that it sucks all of the energy that could be placed towards beginning to cobble together those forces that will be necessary to create a grassroots component that, you know, will be heavily debated and contested and fought over, but that I think could still create the kind of pressure necessary to produce some kind of public health care program or some kind of public college program. But I without the forces around that, that see that as its ultimate objective and not just winning an election, and understanding that even in the very off chance that Sanders were able to win the presidency, that not only would he have to fight the Republican Party, but he'd have to fight half of the Democratic Party. And so what kind of forces would be necessary to overcome that? And we're nowhere near that. I mean, I think in terms of social movements now, that the constitutive elements for a climate justice movement are there, even around immigrant rights, where it doesn't get reported on except locally. But there have been small groups of people and bigger groups of people who have been demonstrating for months now around this country's border and detention policies. And so the constitutive elements are there, but it's yet to be cohered into something I think you could call a social movement. You know, and there are committees around healthcare and all that sort of thing. But I think that until that is able to cohere into a substantial force that has the ability to create pressure, that this is a problem that we will have to confront. In some ways, it doesn't matter if Sanders gets in or not. I think the expectation that something dramatically has to change with the way that healthcare is delivered in this country has been raised. And the issue becomes, how are we going to be in a position to make that happen? The debates, I think, that are important and necessary, even beyond the specific question of politics, I think there's so much situated on the election that we haven't really gotten into that discussion and what that would look like and what it will mean. But I think that it's a necessary part of the discussion that is yet to happen.
I think the rest of it will probably have to wait for another day, but I think this is a good place to come to a close for here. So let me ask you the question we always used to end the podcast, which is, what are three books you've read that have influenced you that you would recommend to the audience?
The first book is Black Reconstruction by W.E.B. Du Bois. It was written in 1935, which is about the Reconstruction era after the Civil War and the promise of democracy and why that ultimately fails. The second book is a collection of poems by John Wieners called The Collected Works of John Wieners. John Wieners was a white man, gay poet, who was writing in the 1950s and 1960s. And his poems resonated deeply with me because of the urbane nature of them. I love cities. I love to think about cities, to write about cities and people who live in cities. And Wiener's poems were actually they were important for me at a time, you know, when I was in my 20s, with no clear idea about what I was doing. But those poems in some ways were an architecture for my interest in urban life, even articulated through the body of this gay white man living in Boston. The last book to swing back to politics is probably Angela Davis's Women, Race, and Class, which I found to be a sophisticated intervention in way of understanding Black women's oppression as an expression of class inequality in the United States, but that was located in the particular experiences of Black women that are shaped by what this country presumes to be their knowledge of its knowledge of Black women, that is very specific, that in the classic kind of way we understand intersectionality, that could not be reduced to questions of just gender and race, but is constructed through the particular ways that Black women have experienced life in this country. So I would say those three are pretty important for me.
Kianga Yamada Taylor, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you to Professor Taylor for being here. Thank you to Cynthia Gill for engineering, to Jeffrey Geld for producing, to Roger Karma for researching. The Ezra Klein Show is a Vox Media Podcast Network production.
This podcast was supported by Choiceology, an original podcast from Charles Schwab. Hosted by Katie Milkman, an award-winning behavioral scientist and author of the best-selling book, How to Change, Choiceology is a show about the psychology and economics behind our decisions. Hear true stories from Nobel laureates, authors, athletes, and more about why we do the things we do. Listen to Choiceology at schwab.com/podcast or wherever you listen.